Welcome to the airport lounge. Table for two gentlemen? Right this way. Here's your booth. Have a great show.
Welcome to the Airport Lounge, the Winnipeg Jets podcast. Much like too many men on the ice penalties, regrettable. I'm Mike Guthrie, and I'm here with my good friend, now referee Tim Peel's new PR director, Vaughn Mitchell. How's it going, Vaughn?
Really good. I'm happy to be doing a fourth episode. I kind of feel like I'm trapped in a Paul Rudd meme, you know, the one that goes, hey, look at us. Who would have thought? Not me. Who would have thought that we would be doing... It's kind of like what Adam Lowry and Andrew Kopp felt after the Vancouver series, I think.
Absolutely. I'm sure them and their agents are sitting around cackling going, we've turned the tables in our favor on this one.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, we touched upon that last week about where they stand contractually. And, you know, Mike, I have to say, I'm very happy that the Hollywood money is starting to come in starting last week. So I'm considering quitting my day job and focusing on the podcast. What do you think? Should I put in my retirement papers?
I think that's an unsound investment in yourself and policy. Sorry, bud. This thing isn't okay. Making jack.
I appreciate your candor on and that, honesty. That's all I ask.
On that, and we hadn't discussed this prior to, because I know, I think you, like me, are uncomfortable with self-promotion to any degree. But I did want to mention, we're in our fourth one, and I thought, you know what, let's mention our Twitter handle. It's at Airport Lounge 55. And I thought, well, like, if you like the podcast a little bit, tell a friend. If you don't have a friend, tell an enemy. Self-promotion, I don't think, comes naturally to either of us. I remember when I was in grade six, I thought it was a wise idea to run for class president. And I was running against a guy named Key Stewart. And shout out to Key Stewart if he's listening, which he's not. But he was more of a taller, skinnier, and more duplicitous Ted Cruz. He kind of had that vibe going for him. And
more
so
duplicitous.
Yes. And I was doing, so it was about a two-week little thing in grade six. And I did zero prep. And he had signs and posters. And he was all in. And so the day of the election, I thought, well, I'm going to get stomped here. I better hail Mary this. So I went to the principal and I convinced him that for me to be able to go on the PA system and give a little shout out and maybe make a joke and hopefully swing the tide. And then Keith Stewart came running in and he was bawling because he thought it was unfair that I got to do it and he didn't. And so, yes, it was very well played. And so he got to do it. Not only that, he got to do his after mine. And needless to say, he won the election in a landslide. Yeah. And so I was trying to think, I was like, well, I don't know what the moral is. I guess don't be a Keith Stewart. But then
he who holds the intercom last.
Right. And then don't be me, because last I heard I think he's like a tech millionaire in California and I'm promoting a free podcast. So the rule of the story is that Keith Stewarts always win.
Yeah, if you like someone or hate someone, you know, tell someone. We just do this for fun, but it is kind of cool to have people listen and give us some feedback. And,
yeah, exactly.
And to see it online, it's super cool. So, thanks to you for listening, and yeah, let's talk some Jets.
Sure. All right. Check-in time. So I just level set 30,000 feet. The Jets are 21-12-2. And I started thinking, like, you go online and you try and stay off hockey Twitter, but there's sort of a large segment of the population who are like, look at our record. We're 21-12-2. We're second in the North Division. All things roses. And then I just started to break it down. And it's like, yeah, but three of the teams in a 17 division are pretty much dumpster fires. Like, we're about, and you alluded to it really well on, I think, the first podcast, like, we're about a 500 team against the Leafs and the Canadiens and the Oilers. And we've stacked up 12, 13 wins against the Canucks and the Senators. And up until last night, we kind of had the Flames number. So, again, I'm not really sure how to evaluate this season thus far. Because, you know, obviously, the point is, well, everyone is playing the same teams. So if you're the second best team, then you're the second best team because everybody has to play the same terrible teams. I don't know why mentally it poses an issue for me where I'm like, I know that we're good, but I think our record is not indicative of just some of the layup wins that we've had. You know, some of the runs we've gone on against terrible teams. So I'm like, like, what are your thoughts? I'm not sure. Am I just overthinking this a bit? Like, should we all be toasting champagne right now?
No, I don't think you're overthinking it. I think this is a very strange team that sort of probably exists outside the parameters of what's normal and usual. I think you're quite right. We have racked up some wins against the lower teams, but I'm sure if you looked at, you know, Toronto has a bad record against Ottawa. So, you know, you can make a lot. Fair. You can, you know, the paralysis by analysis, you know, perspective. And I think we are who we are in the sense that our record is our record. All we can do is play the teams on our schedule. Right? We don't control that. We control the process, or the Jets control their process. So there's those that are looking at it and saying, look at the record. Everything is great. I don't want to hear about the process. And then those who are focused on the process are saying, hey, you know, the process isn't usual. It's atypical. Therefore, I'm going to badmouth the record. And the thing is, they're both right. You know, I think the Jets are a good team. They are. They're talented. They're flawed. But they're winning enough games to put themselves in a position where if things had fallen slightly differently last night, they would have been in first place as we're doing this podcast. But at the same time, their process isn't as tight and impressive as their record is. So what does that mean? Now, if we want to think a little bit outside the box, perhaps their construction of their team is unique in the sense that this is what we're going to get from this team going forward. It's going to be a little bit messy, but there's enough talent there, both in net and up front, that they're going to come away with a bunch of wins. Now, how that manifests within a 7-game series, that's the real question. And I don't think we're getting a good window by looking at what's happening in the regular season to get a good feeling for how that's going to translate into the playoffs.
Yeah, very fair. And, you know, last night was a perfect example where even both games against Calgary, we struggled. I mean, I thought we played well in the first two periods. I thought we had one of our better defensive games in the first one. I thought we were tight with the spaces. In the third period, as we tend to do, we imploded a bit. And the fourth game, or the last game against Calgary, I thought there were numerous defensive breakdowns, and I think you called it before the game. They were a little more physical. They applied a bit more pressure, and we didn't respond well. And that happened in the last playoff against Calgary last year, is that they roughed us up a bit, and we didn't step up to the plate. And so I agree. All of this is great, and being second is great. You know, careful what you wish for. It's just I'm still I got a little trepidation there in terms of how is this going to look in a 7-game series, even in the first round.
Yeah, I think too the way we feel at this exact moment is colored by the game last night. The Fair. Jets were 3-1 last week. That's a good week. You look at the Vancouver games. Again, you can only play the team that's in front of you. Vancouver's not very good.
They're terrible.
Vancouver. I agree. No, you're right. And it wasn't as much about the Jets being good as much as it was about Vancouver being bad. But the Jets beat them twice, and beat them twice handily. What else are we going to ask them to do? They did exactly what you expected them to do. And their goaltending doesn't suck either. Demko played quite well. It could have been even worse than it was. And then they go into Calgary. And again, like just like you said, and I agree, they played pretty well Friday night. Mm-hmm. Last night was disappointing. Maybe it was the expectation that they could have went 4-0 and what that would have meant, that we woke up today a little bit, you know, disappointed. But it was a good week. But again, I think it still goes back to we're not quite sure what this... The team, for me, seemed to try to make a shift recently to a more defensive-oriented approach. They're not cheating for offense or focusing on offense. They're trying to move towards a more low-event type format for them because mm-hmm. I think they're looking forward to the playoffs.
Playoffs? Don't talk about playoffs. You kidding me? Playoffs?
What is the type of hockey we need to play to beat Edmonton and or Toronto? We need to be tight defensively. We need to be way better. So we need to start making that commitment now so that we have, you know, a couple dozen games under our belt of playing this style of hockey because you can't just, you know, turn the switch on and off when playoffs start. You can't just completely change your game.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of wondering if... Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to... Like, Blake Wheeler said that they were really good defensively, so I'm good with that. I think we should just trust his... Yeah. His assessment.
Okay, let's
on
move
it.
On. Yes, we're moving on.
Come on, you break.
The other thing I'll say, just quickly, the Jets have done a pretty decent job of staying out of the box and allowing special teams to be a positive driving force for them. And there was no better example than Friday night. Calgary took 6 penalties. The Jets only took 4. The Jets had 2 power play goals and only 1 for Calgary. So there's the difference in the game. They're staying out of the box. Their penalty killing isn't great. So by staying out of the box, you're reducing the amount of goals you're going to give up on special teams. And, you know, you keep your legs moving and you just, you know, allow the other team to take penalties, which would naturally occur, and then convert on the power play. I mean, that takes pressure off them having to be good 5 versus 5, which the Jets haven't been. So when they can play that type of game, just keep your legs moving, low event hockey 5-on-5, don't take penalties, and allow our very good power play to do its thing. That's perhaps the direction they're moving towards the playoffs.
No, I like it. Do we want to shift to the pre-boarding announcements, get some first class and some penalty box? I have some interesting choices again. All right.
All right.
First class.
I have 1 seat in first class and 1 in coach. The price is the same because your flight was canceled.
Oh. Well, I'll take the first class.
Jerry?
What?
Why should you get the first class?
Elaine, have you ever flown first class?
No.
All right, then. See, you don't know what you're missing. I've flown first class, Elaine. I can't go back to coach. I can't. I won't.
I'm gonna defer. Did I defer to you? I'm doing a lot of deferring. I can go first.
Okay.
Whatever you prefer.
Okay, you go first.
Okay. So I'm going to go, and maybe I'm...
I can just sense how convicted you are in this. You're just convinced this person should be in first class. It's just dripping from your tongue.
Yeah, you can tell. I'm going to go Hellebuck. Kind of a layup. It's against the backdrop of the Brossoit game. It really goes to show you the precarious spot we're in if we're not getting A-plus goal contending. And, you know, a shutout. You should have had a shutout the second game against Vancouver. Mm-hmm. Again, our fate rests in his, you know, more than capable hands. And, you know, we've done... This is our 4th one. He hasn't been promoted to first class yet. And I thought, you know what? This is silly. Every game, he's one of the 2 or 3 most important players on the ice. And so, and I thought he had a good game, all 3 games that he was in. And so I thought, well, let's just rip the Band-Aid right off. Let's get him in here.
Fair enough. I think those are excellent points. And, you know, I tend to, you know, so much is made about him. I tend to discount his contribution. You know, he's very good. Don't get me wrong. You know, in terms of splitting hairs, I think he does an amazing job of allowing the puck to hit him. I don't know how many saves he actually makes. He's just great with his angles. I guess what I'm getting at is his rebound control bugs me. But that is splitting hairs. He is an elite goaltender. We are super lucky to have him. He was 3-0 this week with what should have been 2 shutouts.
Yeah.
A worthy selection of moving into first class.
I'd like that your complaint with him was that he lets the puck hit him. That's the goalie position, no?
Smother the puck, man. Smother the puck.
It's true. His rebound control and, quite frankly, his brazenness in getting out of his net now and making plays, yeah. It gives me heartburn. I wish he'd just stay in the net.
But we're better with him than without him, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
Who I had moving up into first class, who do you think?
I think it's Lowry.
Oh, no. Kopp. Even more obvious. Andrew Kopp.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, here's why. Okay, so yes, he had the 4-goal game, and that's part of what is driving it. I think that, you know, if you're not going to put a guy into first class after he scores 4 goals in a game and wins a nice lady $100,000. Again,
cool.
I'm about the little person and supporting, you know, the workers of the world.
Magnanimous.
So I was happy to see. Yes. So this week he had 4 goals and 2 assists in the 4 games. And he had point contributions in 3 of the 4 games. Only 1 of the 4 was he held off the score sheet. So it wasn't just one big game. I thought he had an amazing assist on Lowry's second goal in the first game.
Yeah.
The pass across the crease. I thought that was fantastic. I think he had a helper on Mason Appleton's goal. I think it was last night. Could be wrong. I felt that if there was ever a time that Andrew Kopp was going to get bumped up into first class, if not now, when? So I think he did enough this week. You know, he won someone $100,000. That in and of itself should be enough to go into first class.
Fair. And I know in our first episode, we came to a consensus. So if we were doing that, my pick would be Kopp as well. I had Kopp, Lowry, and Hellebuck written down, but I had Kopp circled. But I figured one of us was going to say it, so I 100% agree. I thought, you know, obviously that whole line has gelled and has become uber important to our overall success, and I agree. You get a four goal game, you win $700,000, you're in first class now.
Yeah. How about the penalty box? We want to talk about that?
Sure. Give her.
All right.
You do that, you go to the box, you know, 2 minutes by yourself, and you feel shame, you know, and then you get free.
Well, for me, it's easy. It's Laurent Brossoit. He basically ruined the week. Those were two unbelievable goals. I just couldn't believe it. He was literally a funnel on that fourth goal where a puck was going wide and he willfully put his stick out and directed it into his own net. So, no, he also ruined a bit I was working on for this. I thought if the Jets went 4-0 that you and I could just, you know, kind of just be silent and then you could dub in some crickets or some tumbleweeds or something like that.
Wow, great minds. I thought the same thing. I'm like, maybe we just don't have a penalty box this time around.
Well, I don't see how. I mean, the game was 2-2.
Yeah.
I mean, we were being outplayed, but there's nothing to say that we couldn't have. If he doesn't let those two, he didn't even let them in. He put them in. Don't win that game, perhaps in overtime. So, yeah, you know what, Laurent Brossoit, you gorgeous man, you have to go to the penalty box.
You look marvelous.
Yeah, and I was surprised with the reaction. Everyone was pretty kind because that was just an atrocious game, especially obviously the last 2 goals. And everyone was being pretty fair in terms of, because he has played well this year, but this was just an outright stinker, and sometimes that happens. But I agree, he's definitely the penalty box. I'm going I'm probably cheating, and you can veto this if you'd like. But I'm putting Paul Maurice in the penalty box. And again, it's specific to the fourth game. And again, I'm not 100% certain this would have entirely made a difference at all. But I thought in a back-to-back, after we've had some momentum, we've had the same guys playing for 9-10 games in a row, let's put some young legs. Let's put some fresh legs in there. Let's get some energy. Uh-huh. Let's close this thing out. Let's put the death nail in Calgary. And the fact that we went with the same lineup, with the same old guys in the fourth line, like I thought, you know, they've been solid. But I thought Perreault was dragging a bit. You know, there was just a bit of lackluster. Like the first 5 minutes of the first period, I was like, okay, well, we're done. This is as low energy as I've seen us come out in a long time. And I thought Harkins couldn't be in there wheeling around. Like we couldn't have injected some young blood. And I put that on Maurice. I put that, and you touched on it earlier, that he's set. He likes what he likes, and, you know, he'll change the D-lines every, you know, we'll have two good D games and he'll change the D-lines around for some reason. But when it comes to forward lines or putting energy guys in, he just won't do it. And I thought, you know, we have guys who could be eligible. This was a perfect opportunity. We're playing with house money. We've won three in a row. It's a long road trip. Let's, you know, let's rotate some people in and out. Nope, same dudes. And I thought, you know what? Just, you know, because you're right. For the first three games, I'm not really, you know, I think Morrissey kind of, he had a rough one, especially to start off with in the third game. But I thought, no, I think other than Bressois, Paul Maurice is a contributor here. And you know me, anytime I can put him anywhere negative, I'm going to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's a little unprecedented to see a coach go in the penalty box. Maybe we fine him. We can use the money.
Goes to our coffers.
$5,273 fine. Payable to the Airport Lounge podcast. So
I like it.
I'll send him a note.
No, I'm curious. Like, I know I'm stretching the limits of the premise of the bit, but do you agree with some of that in terms of maybe what we could or could not have done there?
I certainly don't disagree. It was a week where a lot of guys played well, so it is kind of difficult to single out one guy. I think I kind of poached the most obvious guy. It's a bit of, when you get talking about Paul Maurice, it can be a bit of, you know, a downward spiral. I mean, that's a conversation that can go in a lot of different directions.
Fair.
I completely feel the same way. You know, mostly I really liked your comment about, you know, on the one hand, he switches up the defense after arguably the soundest two defensive games we had.
Right.
And then, but he uses an entirely different principle for the forwards. It's he's trying, I don't know what he's trying to do. He's, this is preposterous to say, but it's like he's trying to play mind games with the fan base. And that's preposterous, but I don't know. It's, There is a reasoning there that is just not immediately obvious, and he doesn't, you know, for all of his excellence in communication, there are certain things when he sounds more like Kevin Cheveldayoff when he answers. And for me, this is one of them. He kind of talks in circles. He'll give you an answer, and then 2 weeks later, he does something that is 180 degrees different than the answer he gave, or like, this is what I believe. He'll say that to get out of this situation. And then 2 weeks later, you know, and that's the trouble with, or the challenge the mainstream media faces, is they can't throw that back in his face.
Yeah.
They can't, or they just lose access.
You lose access.
So I'm very sympathetic to them and the challenges they face and how it is, a very different reality being in the room with these guys and these coaches and dealing with the organization on a daily basis than, you know, being a keyboard warrior and saying, well, you know, you should ask this or ask that. You know, here we are. We're starting to talk about Paul Maurice and we're going off on big tangents and hopefully we've said some reasonably decent things about him. I think we're pretty clear. We're both frustrated with him in different areas.
Right.
We both agree we don't want this podcast to get into being a deep, dark place where we're all about what's negative. But we're not Paul Maurice fanboys either. Right? And we're just trying to look at what happens and try to make sense of it. And sometimes there's just not enough there.
It doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Fair enough. So we're going to do a player profile. I'm excited for this one. Vaughn, I think you're going to do some, most, or all of the heavy lifting. We have a segment later in the show that I might do a bit more of the heavy lifting. But it's Mason Appleton.
Do you like apples?
Yeah.
Well, I got a number. How do you like them apples?
Yeah, Mason Appleton, he's the guy that has, I think, everyone's been aware of up to this season, but he's really stepped forward. And I think he's really asserting himself as someone that could be on this team for a long time to come. So we wanted to include him as part of our player profile because I think that not a lot is known about him. I didn't know a lot about him. And hopefully we can share a couple things where we know a little bit more about him, because he's kind of unheralded in that way. He didn't come up through the World Junior system, the USA World Junior system. So he wasn't a first-round pick. So he's been very quiet, but he's actually quite an accomplished hockey player. And so I'll quickly touch upon a few things. So he's an American guy born in Green Bay, Wisconsin. He's 25 years old. He's 6'2", 193 pounds.
I've seen 6'3", 6'2", but I had – sorry, and I don't want to derail. No, but I don't know why. Because of the speed, I didn't realize he was that big. Like, 6'3 is a big dude. And I just sort of had a pegged at a, 5'11", 6-foot guy. But, again, with his skill level that you see from time to time and the speed – and to be that big, it's a bit of a complete package.
Yeah, I completely agree. There's probably room to add on a little weight. He could probably get to around 200 pounds. He's not a slight guy. He doesn't play physically, but he's not absent in that regard either. He's a skater, and that's his key attribute, and he uses it very well. Couple interesting things to know in terms about who he is. For his high school team, he helped them win their first state championship, and he scored the winning goal in the second overtime to bring the state championship to that school. Big time player, big time goal in a big time game kind of thing. After high school, he played a year for a team called Tri-City, and from there, it's where he got drafted. Now, I think he had a decent year that year, 12 goals, 40 points, but nothing incredible, and perhaps that led him to be drafted in the sixth round. So after being drafted, I found something that he said that is very intriguing. So this is a sixth round pick, 168th overall. He said, "For me, I kind of don't look at myself as a sixth round pick. I'm a confident player. I'm a confident guy. There's still more to prove. There's room to get better. My goal is to play in the NHL." Ooh. So even as a sixth round pick, he's starting to exhibit, some self-confidence. And again, he's not a guy that we often see quoted in the media or anything like that. So I found that very interesting. So after he was drafted, he went to play for the Michigan State Spartans for a couple years. He ended his rookie season leading all freshmen with 22 points and earned the team's Outstanding Rookie Award. And then after his second season with Michigan State, he was named Team MVP and Outstanding Offensive Player. He was an academic All-Big Ten. Oh, and then after his second season, he was named captain. Now, after that season and before he could ever play a game as captain of Michigan State, he decided to turn pro, and he signed a 3-year contract with the Jets. Now, Michigan State was not very good. They were 10-23-4. Yeah. They were 10-23-4 in 2015-16 and 7-24-4 in 16-17. So not a strong team. But he had, in 72 games played, he had 17 goals, 36 assists, 53 points, and was an impressive minus 45. So again, maybe that feeds into him not being super heralded. He played for this Michigan State
That's
team.
A tough
he played
one.
Well, but they were not very good.
Bayak would love that number. And I love Bayak, but his plus minus, sorry, quick tangent.
Oh, I know.
His plus minus reference, if you're playing a drinking game, that's the one, because he just loves that stat. But anyway, minus 45, it's hard to be minus 45. You have to be on a terrible team.
Yeah, I think Michigan State. And so the reason I brought that up is perhaps they're a team that didn't have a lot of eyes on them. He's not coming in. If it was the reverse, we probably would have heard a lot more about him if the team was winning championships and so on and so forth. So in 2017-18, he came to training camp with the Jets and was subsequently assigned to the Manitoba Moose.
Of course.
And he started the season centering the Moose's fourth line, but quickly moved up the depth chart and was eventually the left winger on the top line. He put up good numbers that season, finishing with 66 points, including 22 goals in 76 games. Now, here's what I found very interesting that I did not know at all. He was subsequently named to the AHL All-Rookie Team and represented the Moose at the AHL All-Star Classic. He also won the AHL Rookie of the Year and was named to the AHL's first All-Star team that year. I did not know that.
Oh, so, yeah. That's actually what I did know that. I remember that when he came up and he was starting to get some ice time, and I can't remember how it came to me, but I was like, well, that's impressive. And I remember Googling and looking at his stats. It's like, oh man, I didn't know he was so prolific in the AHL. And then, you know, you do the bit of a deep dive, like, well, what does AHL, you know, first star mean? And there's some notable names in there. There's some really good hockey players.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, we found another gem.
Yeah, it's not so, I don't know how many people knew that. I didn't know that. You knew it. That's great. But I think that's kind of, it's kind of hit or miss about, like, not much about this guy's past has sort of bubbled up into the general consciousness of Jets
fans. Yeah, fair.
You know, maybe he was kind of coming up around the time, you know, we're winning a lot, and Line A's getting a lot of the media. Anyways, there's more to meet the eye with Mason Appleton than I originally thought. He's driven success at numerous levels of his play. He has self-confidence, like we've talked about. He skates very well. And, you know, not all athletes develop at the same rate. You know, I'll use a bit of a football comparison here. In the most recent Super Bowl, there was only one former five-star recruit on either roster. So Tampa Bay and Kansas City only had... So it takes time.
Really?
People develop... People develop, you know, at different rates, and not all of them are going to be... Not all eventual successful NHL stars or players are 17-year-old, 18-year-old phenoms. You know, statistically, that tends to bear out, but it's not exclusively the case. So we really might have stumbled onto someone here that will have good long-term value. You know, Blake Wheeler is another guy that found the top of his game a bit later in his career.
Mm-hmm.
And Mason Appleton could be, you know, maybe he's not exactly like, well, there's a lot of similarities. I'm not saying his top end is as high as Blake Wheeler's, but, you know, kind of coming up in the same way. Both went through the college system. I think Blake stayed in university for all four of his years where, I mean, you know, you lose that many games for a team, and someone comes and says, hey, do you want to make $750,000 playing, or do you want to keep going to class? They'll say, oh, I'll sign that contract. So overall, I think Mason Appleton translates into a very good third line right wing who can possibly play second line minutes in a supporting role. And I feel the Jets should strongly consider finding a way to protect Appleton in the upcoming Seattle expansion draft. And I think we briefly touched upon that last week.
Yeah.
But I want to emphasize that. That's my – I mean, they have a lot of moves to make, I think, before they can finalize their position for the expansion draft. But I would like to see Appleton protected. What are your thoughts, Mike?
Yeah, 100% agree. He's definitely one. I think he's made himself invaluable to the third line, and I agree that I could see him in a second line role, you know, more of a supportive, but sort of a Paul Stastny type. And what I love about him is the drive to the net. He's fearless, and he's always, like, once a game, he's in underneath the goalie's pads. Like, that's just his jam, right? And we don't have a lot of guys like that, pros like that a bit, but he's always charging the net, and that's valuable. And it's funny, I thought, well, what the sort of public opinion on him, let's say 1 year, 2 years ago, and this is a good reminder that opinions are fleeting, because I read something on Arctic Hockey, which, you know, it's a great site, I like that site, and they're basically, trade him, he's dispensable. And to your point exactly, this is what happens. Some guys, they burst into the NHL right away, you can tell. Yeah. Other guys, takes a bit of time, takes a bit of tutelage, takes a bit of grooming. And I think Appleton's one of them. Because essentially that was the synopsis at the end of this piece was, he's just a guy. And right now, we're probably, I have to check my swings and balances. Like, but I think he's a valuable piece, and I think he should be protected, just like you said.
I agree.
So we're not all corporate greedy pigs here at the Airport Lounge. We also want to provide a service. And so when the Men's Sartorial Society reached out and asked if they could have some airtime to promote a very worthy cause. Both Van and I thought...
Very worthy.
Yes. Both Van and I thought, yes, let's give them the space. So here is their message.
Public service announcement.
Hey, babe. You almost ready? Wow. Is that what you're wearing?
Sun's out, guns out, babe.
Is a tank top really the right choice for my parents' anniversary dinner?
Has this ever happened to you? Worse yet, is this you? The Men's Sartorial Society is here to inform you that scientists have confirmed that only 7% of adult males look good in a tank top. That means, statistically, you should never wear one. Some may say, hey, fictitious men's organization, it's really hot outside and I'm just going to the grocery store. That's okay, right? No. No, it's not. We here at the MSS understand that for some unknown reason, dad bods are currently on vogue. But tank tops are barely flattering on Brad Pitt. Brad fucking Pitt. Brad Pitt, you agree with us, correct?
Slightly more complicated than that.
Never mind, you handsome dummy. Trust us, sleeves are good. So, the next time you're headed out the door, remember, if it doesn't have a sleeve, you shouldn't leave.
Now that is a better shirt. Doesn't it feel better?
Yes, but I won't be able to feel the wind and sun on my guns.
Now let's talk about those jean shorts.
And that's one to grow on.
Good message. 100% concur.
Words to live by. Brad Pitt. How about Brad Pitt?
How did we get him? I will say, and this is not pandering. My brother's one of the 7% who can pull off a tank top. Your chances are, like the message said, statistically, you're not one of them. Vaughn, this was what I thought humbly was a really good idea and a really good topic to dig into. Was that we spend, and I know pundits and analysts spend a lot of time analyzing the fourth line of the Jets and the fourth line in hockey. There's a lot of time spent about who should be in and who should be out, and I'm wildly guilty of it myself, where, you know, on our first podcast, I had a little rant about Nate Thompson being not someone that I was super enthused with, and so... We wanted to give some context and how important is the fourth line? Why do we discuss it so much? Should we discuss it so much? So I thought we could do that here.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. So I wanted to, I guess just for a bit of context, like obviously, and I'm stating some obvious things here, but the fourth line over the past decade has changed. Everyone knows this. Hockey has changed. The fourth line, and Vaughn, if you disagree, obviously we can discuss it. But, you know, the fourth line was traditionally, you get some enforcers in there, you get some gritty guys, they'll play some tough minutes. But if you're looking for them to fill the score sheet at all or provide slick or a semblance of sort of quote-unquote pretty hockey, you're not looking to the fourth line for that. That has evolved, and to my mind, at least to my recollection, sort of the 2011 Blackhawks were the first time where I can recall where I heard, well, they're just running four straight forward lines, and their fourth line is more skilled than any fourth line than any of their competitors, and that gives them an advantage. And since then, the evolution has continued. And, you know, like, we used to wheel out the Glasses and the Slaters and the Pelusos and the Hendricks and the Stapletons, and, you know, we had a chant, GST, for Cribbity's sake, with the Glass line. And again, serviceable NHLers for the time, but nobody that you were really excited about. And I think the transition has happened where some folks believe that we should go back to the Don Cherries, think we should go back to the enforcer role. And others are like, well, no, just get as much talent on that line as you possibly can. What are your thoughts in terms of structurally what a fourth line should look like in this day and age?
You know, it's a great question, and I think it really is interwoven into where you are as a franchise and what you want to accomplish. Now, what you want to avoid, certainly, is having a preset principle as to what it needs to be, and then fitting in your guys, rightly or wrongly, into roles that they may or may not be suited for. And I think with the Jets, there's a strong belief that we want to roll three lines and we want to have that fourth line mm-hmm. having three shifts a period. We don't want to run four lines. There's a reason why Scheifele gets $6 million and Connor gets $7 million and Wheeler gets $10 million. Those guys, because they get the money, they need to drive the play. They need the minutes in order to drive the play. Now, I think how it ties in with your organization is, you know, should we have cheap veterans taking those fourth line minutes? Say it's mm-hmm. about 7 to 9 minutes a night, or should those go to young guys? So, and it's an open question. Like, would they be better playing 18, 19 minutes in the AHL and being a first line player in the AHL for a season or two? Or is it better for them to be on that fourth line and get acquainted with all of the rigors of playing in the NHL? They don't get the same ice time, but they get experience in a different way. So there's a bit of a philosophical approach there. And I think the Jets are very clearly in the camp that we want to roll three lines. We don't want to have young players playing on that fourth line. Mm-hmm. We want the young players playing in the AHL. Now, that's fine in theory, and it's worked with a couple guys, the Logan Stanleys and Mason Appletons of the world, maybe to a small extent Kyle Connor, who benefited from a little time down in the AHL. But it seems like it's a philosophy that is to an extent they've wrecked a couple players too. I think that
Patan,
you know, and Sammy Niku. I mean, there's going to be certain guys, and there seems to be like, well, there's a height and weight requirement to play on the fourth line too. I mean, as you mentioned, the fourth line had a traditional view and it was called an energy line, and they go out there and they smash people for 45 seconds and then they come and sit down, or they tap someone on the shin pads, let's go. And so what do you want from that fourth line? And I think that can vary from team to team, from coach to coach. And as we've discussed before, here we are. We're back talking about Paul Maurice. He's got a very antiquated view of what a roster should do and how it should function. And we're seeing that manifest itself in the fourth line. Very traditional. We want old guys out there that I can trust. I don't have to coach them. They're out there three shifts a period. I don't need to explain to them. They're not in my office every third day asking for more minutes, asking why they're not on the power play.
Fair.
So whatever the case may be. But overall, my perspective is I think the people that complain about the fourth line may be right, but even if they got their way, it's not going to have a material impact on our wins and losses.
So that's where I wanted. So to me, it's somewhat of a math problem, because you nailed it, where your fourth line is about 8 to 12 minutes a night, given the organization.
Yeah.
And you know, they're paid less, they play less, and they produce less. And so, but you have a certain salary for your team. So I thought, well, what right now, somewhat anecdotally, who's the best fourth line in the NHL? And again, this is subject to debate, obviously, but the New York Islanders, the Cal Clutterbuck, the Matt Martin, and Casey, and I'm going to spell this wrong, or say this wrong, Cizikas?
Yeah, I think you got that right.
Oh, my goodness. Gold star. Yeah. But they are consensus, I guess, considered one of the better fourth lines out there. And, okay, well, that's great. How did they do that? Well, their cap, the Islanders' cap, is about $86 million. About $44 million of that goes to forwards. And Kel, Matt, and Casey make about 8.5. So that's about 20% of your forward cap on your fourth line.
Yeah.
Okay, what about the Jets? Well, Lewis and Thompson make league minimum, so that's about 1.5. And Perreault is a bit of an anomaly on the fourth line, and he makes 4.1. So that's about $6.5 million. And we're at a cap of about $83 million. But we pay our forwards, and you alluded to it, we're top-heavy. All of our top guys make more than the Islanders. And so we pay about 12.5% of our cap to the fourth line. So an 8% difference, that's a big deal. And you're going to probably get, you would hope anyway, you're going to get more production with an 8% pay difference between the two fourth lines. And, you know, I've read some dissertations in terms of what you should really do is focus on paying third lines rather than fourth lines. Mm-hmm. Just get whomever in the fourth line, because at the end of the day, yeah, production-wise, it doesn't really matter. But the Islanders are, you know, you think, well, if we want a better fourth line, then we can't pay Wheeler 8.25. We can't pay Connor 7.1. Like, Barzal makes 7 and Brock makes 6 on the Islanders, and those are their two highest paid players. So it's a choice. It's an organizational choice, and we're top heavy, and we're leaning into that, right? Where it's like, no, we're going to have a really good top six. We're going to have a good goalie, and the rest we're going to kind of have fill in as we go. And so this exercise was a learning lesson for me, because I get all worked up. You've seen me about the Matt Hendrickses and the Nate Thompsons, and why can't we have better people on that line? And when you break down the math, it's like, well, that's why. You know, but your point is an excellent one, in that my position is that I think we should use that space for young guys, and Maurice has chosen not to do that. But we have a limited space within to do that, because we have a very minimal amount of money to slot in for our fourth line. And, you know, this is how it's manifested itself. But we just can't spend $8.5 million on a third line.
Yeah, there's a contract situation here. If, you know, in terms of the years that count towards their UFA and RFA status, and that it's different if they're in the AHL than the NHL. And we're trying to maximize the time they have, or we have control over their contract. So that means putting them down maybe a little bit longer. Then if they're up, they're counting years towards that. So, you know, we'd have to be drafting hyper successfully to continue having young guys on that fourth line. And then they would probably get to a point where they would need to be in that second and third contract a lot earlier. And there's no cap space for them. So we need to get rid of them. So it's tough. I just don't think it's going to matter. I think you need to lean on your best players. I don't think there's any justification for giving four lines 15 minutes a night when you have Blake Wheeler making $10 million a year. And you have Trevor Lewis making $750,000 a year to play the same position. It just doesn't make sense to me. I think, generally speaking, you know, I can take my issue with the construction of the various lines, but the application of those lines, you know, in terms of minutes, I think is fine. I don't think that it makes sense to be putting Scheifele against McDavid just because they're the two top lines. I don't think we should do that. But that doesn't mean I think Mark Scheifele and his line shouldn't be getting 18 to 20 minutes a night. I think they should. I just don't think they should be against Connor McDavid or Austin Matthews.
No.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I want to manipulate it so that they're out against the other team's fourth line. You know, that's what I would want to do. But again, there's a lot of different layers here. It is definitely an onion that, you know, you peel it back. There's a lot of assumptions, a lot of organizational sort of philosophical perspectives rolled in there. But at the end of the day, I am not going to waste my energy on the fourth line, because even if the pundits, the keyboard warriors got their exact perfect fourth line,
you can see
it is not going to make a difference. It's not going to make a difference.
Well, before we get to trivia, I'm going to tease something for the next one. I have a pretty funny Tim Stapleton story. We were out with him one night, and that dude is a legend. He's no taller than 5'7", but he makes his presence felt. But anyway, we'll get to that next week. Trivia time.
Okay. You want to go first again?
I'll go first. Something came up where we were talking about nicknames through a work email thread. And I was like, I don't know other than you know, some of the Great One and the Golden Jet. And I was like, I don't know if hockey is rife with good, solid nicknames. And I thought, well, let's put Vaughn to the test. And I've got a list, probably too many, but I tried to keep it Jet-centric, but some of them were too good to pass up. So I'm gonna list the nickname, and if you can, provide who that nickname is for. Okay. I'll start with some current Jets.
Okay.
Fly.
Oh, that's Nick Ehlers.
Boom. This one, I smoke. Right.
Smoke.
Yeah.
You got me.
DeMello, somehow.
Oh.
Yeah, and he himself was like, I don't know how I got that nickname.
Maybe DeMaurier. Someone called him DeMaurier.
Players rich.
Boom. Yeah.
Peeler.
Peeler.
Defenseman.
Pionk. I don't know.
Yep, done. Boom.
All right. There you go.
Do you, I didn't know this, so I apologize. This is not a current Jets player, but a former Jets player. Walt.
Oh, Keith Kachuk.
Man, you're good at this. My boy's wicked smart. Yeah, there was a Walt Kachuk in the 70s, yeah. And somehow that caught on. Bones. He was a former Jet. Old school.
Bones. From way back in the day?
Yeah.
Goalie. Barry Long. Oh, I don't know.
Gary Bromley, sorry.
Gary, oh, jeez. Yeah, I don't feel bad about not getting that one.
I got some Manitobans here. Pancakes.
Oh, Dustin Penner.
And the story was that he hurt his back eating pancakes. And he has since gone to Crazy Town on Twitter, if you want to check that out.
Oh, yeah.
Captain Sirius.
Oh, Jonathan Taves.
Okay. These ones are just interesting to me. The charcuterie cucumber.
Charcuterie cucumber.
Yeah. There's an award named after him.
Rajon Houl. I don't know.
George Vezina. And there was another one that I don't know. The suitcase. And that was, he was a former WWE.
Gary Smith.
Oh, look at you.
Oh, well, he had played. A great hockey card.
Really?
He had a great. Oh, yeah. Had his hockey card.
How would you know Gary Smith?
Gary Suitcase Smith. pay attention. I don't know.
Good for you. Okay, that was it. You crushed more of those than I thought. Well done, as usual.
Okay. All right. I got one for you. Again, the theme, the topic is Nick Antropoff.
Okay.
Okay. Hopefully this isn't too kind of weird. Okay. So two numbers based. What was the most goals scored by Nick Antropoff in an NHL season? Was it A, 24, B, 25, C, 26, or D, 30? Or none of the above, all of the above. No, I'm just kidding. Just the four. A, 24, four. B, 25, C, 26, or D, 30.
Okay.
The most goals.
I'm pretty sure he was never a 30 goal scorer. So I'm going to eliminate that. I'm going to do this the millionaire style. I'm going to start eliminating and sound like a real moron. So I'm pretty sure it's not 30 and then.
Correct. Correct. It was not D. I'll help 24. You along.
It's 25 or 26. I'm going to go 26.
Okay. I'm going to tell you. Okay. That's your final answer?
That's my final answer, but probably not now.
No, correct. It is 26. Okay, here's the bonus question.
Okay.
Which team was he playing for when he scored this total?
Oh, that would have to be the Maple Leafs.
Yeah, correct.
Okay.
In 2007, 2008, he scored 26 goals. He also scored 24 goals a couple years before or later. I can't remember. He did score 24 goals in a year, 1 year.
Yeah, you know what? Like, we obviously we've made a good deal of jokes, but he was a talented guy, and he had his moments. Like, 26 goals in a season that's pretty darn good.
Nothing to shake a stick at. Yeah. And he was in Toronto for like 9 years or something like that. Like, he was in Toronto for a long time. They don't mess around there. If you're not good, they're going to run you out of town.
And you will get run out of town.
Exactly. He big guy, 6'4", 235, scored goals. Very respectable career. So, yeah, kudos.
Props to Antropoff. All right, last call, my friend. Last call!
The last call. Okay, so this week the Jets are going to play four games, probably before the next time we do another podcast, they'll have played four games. This includes Monday in Calgary for the final game against the Flames. Wednesday, they start a two-game stretch against Toronto. And then Sunday, they're at home in the first of two against Vancouver. Now, the Jets are 4-2-1 so far against the Flames. So, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what to think after last night. Maybe it's just a bad taste in my mouth. But I do think that I think it's pretty obvious to say that the two games against Toronto are going to be critical. You know, they're going to go a long way to determining the seeding of the top three, which I think will be critical for the Jets. I don't.
Who would you like to play to first? If you had your druthers.
Easily. I would want to play Montreal first. Second, I'd much rather play Toronto than Edmonton. I think we match up much better against Toronto than Edmonton. I just don't think we can handle McDavid and Draisaitl on the same line. I just don't think.
No, and I don't want to watch Connor McDavid pumping goals on us for four games. Or seven games, whatever it goes to.
So there's no back-to-back games this week, so I really think we're going to see Hellebuck three times at least, depending on where we're at. Maybe we get Brassois in the first of two against Vancouver at the back end. But I think we have a big week coming up. It'll be very interesting to see what team emerges against Calgary, the team that looked pretty good in game one or the team that was pretty disinterested in game two. So we'll see. So there'll be lots to talk about next week. How do you think we're going to do?
I think if the Calgary Flames wear those terrible, god-awful Santa Fe, some sort of bastardized jerseys that they wore, man, those are hideous. I think we take ones? One. Yeah. Did you like those?
It's not that I like them, but I just hate red. The red ones are, I just hate the color.
Really?
Red.
Oh, okay. I like the red ones. That's a side. That's a whole other conversation. I think we're going to go, I'm doing this just to be safe, but I think we're going to go 2-2 again. Like, I think I'm worried about Toronto. I think we had that good run against them, and everything's cyclical, right? Like, I can just see us having one bad game and then one that they kind of squeak out in overtime or something. So I'm going to go 2-2.
I'm going to go 2-1-1. I agree with you, but I like that the fact those games are at home and we get the last change. Although Paul Maurice doesn't do enough, I think, with the last change. I still think there's it's better that we have it than if we don't. I think if a gun were put to my head, I think we respond well and play well against Calgary. I think we split with Toronto. And by then, I don't know, who knows where Vancouver's going to be mentally by that one. So I'm going to go 2-1-1. I think we have another, pretty good, but kind of, at the same time, middling type week. And we're going to stay in the hunt for first place.
I like it. I like it, my man.
Okay. So, fellow travelers, that's it for this episode of the podcast. Thanks for listening. And be sure to come back next week to the Airport Lounge, because the first round is always on us. Until then, go Jets, go.
Thanks, everyone.